Chapter 2. Initiation. 1. The Road of Trials. Once having traversed the threshold, the hero moves in a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms, where he must survive a succession of trials. This is a favorite phase of the myth adventure. It has produced a world literature of miraculous tests and ordeals. The hero is covertly aided by the advice, amulets, and secret agents of the supernatural helper, whom he met before his entrance into this region. Or it may be that he here discovers for the first time that there is a benign power everywhere supporting him in his superhuman passage. One of the best known and most charming examples of the difficult tasks motif is that of Psyche's quest for her lost lover, Cupid. Here, all the principal roles are reversed. Instead of the lover trying to win his bride, it is the bride trying to win her lover. And instead of a cruel father withholding his daughter from the lover, it is the jealous mother Venus hiding her son, Cupid, from his bride. When Psyche pleaded with Venus, the goddess grasped her violently by the hair and dashed her head upon the ground, then took a great quantity of wheat, barley, millet, poppy seed, peas, lentils, and beans, mingled these all together in a heap, and commanded the girl to sort them before night. Psyche was aided by an army of ants. Venus told her next to gather the golden wool of certain dangerous wild sheep, sharp of horn and poisonous of bite, that inhabited an inaccessible valley in a dangerous wood. But a green reed instructed her how to gather from the reeds round about the golden locks shed by the sheep in their passage. The goddess now required a bottle of water from a freezing spring, high on a towering rock beset by sleepless dragons. An eagle approached and accomplished the marvelous task. Psyche was ordered, finally, to bring from the abyss of the underworld a box full of supernatural beauty. But a high tower told her how to go down to the world below, gave her coins for Charon and sops for Cerberus, and sped her on her way. Psyche's voyage to the underworld is but one of innumerable such adventures undertaken by the heroes of fairy tale and myth. Among the most perilous are those of the shamans of the peoples of the farthest north, the Lapps, Siberians, Eskimo, and certain American Indian tribes, when they go to seek out and recover the lost or abducted souls of the sick. The shaman of the Siberians is clothed for the adventure in a magical costume representing a bird or reindeer, the shadow principle of the shaman himself, the shape of his soul. His drum is his animal, his eagle, reindeer, or horse. He is said to fly or ride on it. The stick that he carries is another of his aids, and he is attended by a host of invisible familiars. An early voyager among the Lapps has left a vivid description of the weird performance of one of these strange emissaries into the kingdoms of the dead. Since the yonder world is a place of everlasting night, the ceremonial of the shaman has to take place after dark. The friends and neighbors gather in the flickering, dimly lighted hut of the patient and follow attentively the gesticulations of the magician. First, he summons the helping spirits. These arrive, invisible to all but himself. Two women in ceremonial attire, but without belts and wearing linen hoods, a man without hood or belt, and a girl not as yet adult are in attendance. The shaman uncovers his head, loosens his belt and shoestrings, covers his face with his hands, and begins to twirl in a variety of circles. Suddenly, with very violent gestures, he shouts, "Fit out the reindeer! Ready to boat!" Snatching up an axe, he begins striking himself about the knees with it and swinging it in the direction of the three women. He drags burning logs out of the fire with his naked hands. He dashes 3 times around each of the women and finally collapses like a dead man. During the whole time, no one has been permitted to touch him. While he reposes now in trance, he is to be watched so closely that not even a fly may settle upon him. His spirit has departed, and he is viewing the sacred mountains with their inhabiting gods. The women in attendance whisper to each other, trying to guess in what part of the yonder world he now may be.
The women may be unable to locate the shaman's position in the yonder world, in which case his spirit may fail to return to the body. Or the wandering spirit of an enemy shaman may engage him in battle or else lead him astray. It is said that there have been many shamans who failed to return.
If they mention the correct mountain, the shaman stirs either a hand or a foot. At length, he begins to return. In a low, weak voice, he utters the words he has heard in the world below. Then the women begin to sing. The shaman slowly awakes, declaring both the cause of the illness and the manner of sacrifice to be made. Then he announces the length of time it will take for the patient to grow well. Another observer reports,
"On his laborious journey, the shaman has to encounter and master a number of differing obstacles, budak, which are not always easily overcome. After he has wandered through dark forests and over massive ranges of mountains, where he occasionally comes across the bones of other shamans and their animal mounts who have died along the way, he reaches an opening in the ground. The most difficult stages of the adventure now begin, when the depths of the underworld, with their remarkable manifestations, open before him. After he has appeased the watchers of the kingdom of the dead and made his way past the numerous perils, he comes at last to the lord of the underworld, Erlik himself, and the latter rushes against him, horribly bellowing. But if the shaman is sufficiently skillful, he can soothe the monster back again, with promises of luxurious offerings. This moment of the dialogue with Erlik is the crisis of the ceremonial. The shaman passes into an ecstasy."
In every primitive tribe, writes Dr. Geza Roheim, we find the medicine man in the center of society, and it is easy to show that the medicine man is either a neurotic or a psychotic, or at least that his art is based on the same mechanisms as a neurosis or a psychosis. Human groups are actuated by their group ideals, and these are always based on the infantile situation. The infancy situation is modified or inverted by the process of maturation, again modified by the necessary adjustment to reality, yet it is there and supplies those unseen libidinal ties without which no human groups could exist. The medicine men, therefore, are simply making both visible and public the systems of symbolic fantasy that are present in the psyche of every adult member of their society. They are the leaders in this infantile game and the lightning conductors of common anxiety. They fight the demons so that others can hunt the prey, and in general, fight reality. And so it happens that if anyone, in whatever society, undertakes for himself the perilous journey into the darkness by descending, either intentionally or unintentionally, into the crooked lanes of his own spiritual labyrinth, he soon finds himself in a landscape of symbolical figures, any one of which may swallow him, which is no less marvelous than the wild Siberian world of the Pudak and sacred mountains. In the vocabulary of the mystics, this is the second stage of the way, that of the purification of the self, when the senses are cleansed and humbled, and the energies and interests concentrated upon transcendental things. Or in a vocabulary of more modern turn, this is the process of dissolving, transcending, or transmuting the infantile images of our personal past. In our dreams, the ageless perils, gargoyles, trials, secret helpers, and instructive figures are nightly still encountered. And in their forms, we may see reflected not only the whole picture of our present case, but also the clue to what we must do to be saved. I stood before a dark cave wanting to go in, was the dream of a patient at the beginning of his analysis, and I shuddered at the thought that I might not be able to find my way back. I saw one beast after another, Emanuel Swedenborg recorded in his dream book for the night of October 19th to 20th, 1744, and they spread their wings and were dragons. I was flying over them, but one of them was supporting me.
Swedenborg's own comment on this dream was as follows. Dragons of this kind, which do not reveal themselves as dragons until one sees their wings, symbolize false love. I am just now writing on this subject.
And the dramatist Friedrich Hebbel recorded a century later, April 13, 1844, "In my dream, I was being drawn with great force through the sea. There were terrifying abysses with here and there a rock to which it was possible to hold." Themistocles dreamed that a snake wound itself around his body, then crept up to his neck, and when it touched his face, became an eagle that took him in its talons and, carrying him upward, bore him a long distance and set him down on a golden herald's staff that suddenly appeared, so safely that he was all at once relieved of his great anxiety and fear. The specific psychological difficulties of the dreamer frequently are revealed with touching simplicity and force. I had to climb a mountain. There were all kinds of obstacles in the way. I had now to jump over a ditch, now to get over a hedge, and finally to stand still because I had lost my breath. This was the dream of a stutterer. I stood beside a lake that appeared to be completely still. A storm came up abruptly, and high waves arose, so that my whole face was splashed. The dream of a girl afraid of blushing, erythrophobia, whose face, when she blushed, would become wet with perspiration. I was following a girl who was going ahead of me along the dark street. I could see her from behind only, and admired her beautiful figure. A mighty desire seized me, and I was running after her. Suddenly a beam, as though released from a spring, came across the street and blocked the way. I awoke with my heart pounding. The patient was a homosexual, the transverse beam a phallic symbol.